I don't know whether you saw in the news last week an article about the percentage of people who believe in the resurrection. Specifically, the percentage of Christians, people who would self-identify as Christians. The article said this: while 44% of the population overall believes Christ returned from death, according to the Bible story, the figure rises to just 72% among Christians, despite the event being a central part of the faith. As we gather this morning to remember the resurrection, to celebrate the resurrection, it begs the question, do we believe that it happened? Do you believe that Jesus Christ, a man in Israel 2,000 years ago, physically, literally died, and then 2 days later rose again? And if he did, what difference does that make? That's really the question that we're asking this morning. We're doing three sections. Resurrection reality, did it happen? Resurrection relationships, what does it look like to know the risen Jesus? And then resurrection response, what does the resurrection mean for us? So that's where we're going over the next few minutes, those three: resurrection reality, resurrection relationships, resurrection response. So the first one is, well, reality, did it happen? Sarah's just read to us John's account. John is one of, as Tim mentioned earlier, one of Jesus' inner circle, close friends, and he records the account of what happened on that first Easter Sunday, 2 days after the crucifixion of Jesus, which he's also recorded in his account. So let's walk through and pick out some of the clues. Did it happen? It's early on the Sunday morning, sometime before dawn, John tells us, and Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb. As a Jew, she wouldn't have been able to go on the Saturday because it would have made her unclean. So she wasn't allowed, but she goes before dawn, you know, early as she can possibly go. She goes to the tomb on the Sunday morning. She goes as soon as she can. Jesus' body has been laid in a tomb, in like a cave. His death has been verified. If you read the account of Jesus' death, he's on the cross. They go to see. They go to break his legs to make him die quicker. They find that he's already dead. And they plunge a spear into his side. Mary is a follower of Jesus. She's somebody who has met and been healed by Jesus. And she loves him. And she was there when he was crucified. And now she goes to the tomb. She watched on. She watched on, heard Jesus' words from the cross. His words of forgiveness. His words, his declaration of fulfillment. It is finished. And now she goes to attend to his body. And she arrives at the tomb, only to see that somebody has rolled away the massive stone that covers the entrance to the tomb. The great stone has been pushed to one side. The grave was open. And she dare not look any closer or any further in. What has happened? And so she runs. She runs to find two of Jesus' closest friends, Simon Peter and John, the disciple whom Jesus loved. That's what how John describes it here. He's the author of this account. And the three of them go back to the tomb. And John and Peter, they too see that the tomb is empty. Three things in the account I just want to pull out for us, just to say, look, this rings true. The first one is that the key witness to the resurrection is Mary. Mary is a woman. Seems obvious to us. But in Jewish society, she would not have been considered to be a reliable witness because she was a woman. If you were writing an account to convince people, you would have had a man, first off, and somebody respectable, a key, believable witness. But and yet here it is, it's Mary. She's the first witness. For a religion, Christianity, that's accused of being sexist, it's funny, it's almost ironic that the key figure in witnessing the key event is Mary, a woman. She is the first to see the risen Christ. Secondly, look at the eyewitness details. Look down again at the account. See how John describes the running. Why does he need to mention the running?
Why does he need to mention the time that it took? See how he describes the race, the competitive race that goes on between Peter and John.
They both ran, but the
verse 4, both are running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. Notice the details about the grave clothes. All these little things that don't add anything really to the account. They just happened. It's just noted down by John because that's what he saw. It's not some great design that the grave clothes have specific meaning and add to the account that he's trying to build up. He just said, oh, I was there and this is what happened. And thirdly, notice the realism. After Peter and John had come to the tomb and John hangs back and Peter runs in and then John goes in and they see and we're told that John believes, and then what do? Well, they go back to where they were staying. They don't hang around. They don't start calling people in. They go back. It's not some great declaration, some great instant moment of, it all changed here. As John tells the account, he just says, yeah, and then they went back to where they were staying. It's gradual, it's messy. It's quite frankly believable because it just smells like real life. There's enough in these few short verses to give us just a little bit of friction, some grounding, to think that maybe, just possibly, this is a true account. An account that we can trust. And I say that not because I doubt it, but because we recognise that when we come to talking about the resurrection, and we come to talk about trusting the Bible's account, that's a big leap. We don't naturally have a thing where we say, yeah, the Bible's true. We don't naturally believe that somebody rose from the dead. But maybe there's just a few crumbs in here which makes, I just want to say, look, here, just there's a little bit here to make you go, okay, that sounds as though it could ring sort of true in his account. I want us to have just a little bit of confidence as we look at what happens to Mary and to Peter and John, that maybe this could be a true account. And I recognise that we're not all coming this morning saying, yeah, I believe this is true. So just hold on to those things, those realistic elements. Those things that maybe just begin to feel a bit, oh, okay, this could be trusted. But let's ask the question now, what does it look like to meet, to know the risen Jesus? Look at resurrection relationships. This is now Mary's story. While Peter and John head back to their lodgings in the city, back into the city of Jerusalem, she remains. Here's Mary. She's at the end of hope. She's running on empty. She's emotionally stricken. The person that she had trusted in to change everything, the source of her whole, her hopes, her dreams, her expectations, was dead. And he was gone. No body, no dignity, no chance to even say goodbye. Just 2-3 days previously, Mary was somebody who looked at Jesus and said, this is it. This person changes everything. We know from elsewhere in the Bible that Mary is somebody who had been healed by Jesus. And now she stands by the empty grave. And she looks, bends down once again to look into the grave. Just to check. Maybe I missed it. She's alone in her grief, and yet suddenly she's not alone. Just look down again at verse 11. See the bold title, Jesus Appears to Mary Magdalene. Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. And they asked her, woman, why are you crying? Why are you crying? On the surface of it seems a harsh question. It seems, well, it's so obvious. It's so obvious why she's crying. Because somebody she loved, somebody she'd had hope and expectations and her dreams all planted in, a person was dead and gone. And she says, because they have taken my Lord away. And maybe if we read between the lines, we could say, she might well have said, because my hope is gone. Because without Jesus, the future is bleak. The only person, the only thing that's changed my life for the better, with hope of it being permanently changed, has been taken away. He's dead. And I don't even know where his body is to grieve over. Ultimately, for Mary at least, a crucified Jesus, a dead Jesus, is the source only of tears. There's no joy, no hope. Hope is extinguished. They have taken my Lord away. She is devastated, broken, and hopeless. And then somebody else enters the scene. Somebody else comes into the picture, and it is Jesus. Verse 14, at this she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. And Jesus answered the same thing, "Woman, why are you crying?" And it almost seems cruel at this point. Why are you crying? Through her tears, she doesn't recognize him. Not because of the tears, but her mind, her heart cannot comprehend how it could possibly be Jesus talking to her. And yet, it's not the sight of Jesus, but the voice of Jesus that changes that. Mary. Mary, in a word, speaking her name, Jesus plunges into the very depths of her being just by calling out her name. And we know that when we use a name, it's more than just an identifier. When somebody uses your name, they know something of you. They know who you are. They're recognizing how you think, how you work, how you feel. He recognizes her when she does not recognize him. He knows her. And he speaks to her, communicating his desire to be in a relationship with her, not in some seedy Dan Brown, Da Vinci Code sort of way, but in a real way. He speaks and she hears, and they're connected. Mary, a word that communicates, seeing her, knowing her, loving her, wanting her, welcoming her. And as Jesus speaks that word, her eyes are open and she recognizes him. Earlier in this account of the life of Jesus, John has recorded what Jesus has said about people who follow him. Jesus described himself as a shepherd. Listen to these words. "The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he has brought out all his own, he goes on ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice." Jesus is painting the picture of him being a shepherd and calling out to the sheep, and the sheep recognizing the voice. That's exactly what we see here. Mary hears his voice and she recognizes that she belongs to him. Jesus is calling people to himself, his sheep. He knows them by name. He knows their ways. He knows their history. He knows their character. He knows their fears, their doubts, their failings, their dreams, their hopes. He knows them all. He knows them fully. And Jesus calls people to himself. He calls out their name, my name. Maybe even this morning he's calling your name. Without words, he's saying, "I know you. I know your life. I know the way you've lived. I know your heart. I know what nobody else knows. I know the thoughts in the darkness. I know you and I love you. I have died for you. I have paid for your wrongdoing. And I have come back to life. I've been raised to new life so that you might know God. That you might know joy. I am alive, he says. And I have come that you have, might have hope instead of hopelessness. Joy instead of tears. That's what we see as Mary meets the risen Jesus in a word. And it leads to ask the question, okay, well, if this is what it looks like to meet Jesus, well, what does it mean for us? What is the right response to the resurrection? It's funny, sometimes we say, if I could only see, if I could only see Jesus, then I would believe. But in this account of Jesus raised to new life, we see two instances where it's not seeing Jesus that makes the difference. Two incidents of believing not coming from seeing Jesus, from seeing the evidence and from hearing Jesus. Look at firstly at John. John, the disciple who Jesus loved. John writes, and all the way through his account, he's saying repeatedly, I'm telling you this so that you might believe. So John, as he looks on as Jesus dies, talks about the spear being plunged, just in the previous chapter, into the side of Jesus, and he says, this is why I write this, why I witness to it, so that you might believe. And at the end of this account, as he's clearing up at the end of this chapter, verse 31, John says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. So I've picked out a few key events. He says, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the chosen one, the anointed one, the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John says, I'm writing this. I'm writing this account so that you, the reader, whoever the original readers were that he was writing to, and it certainly applies to us. He says, I'm writing this so you might believe, that you might have a life-altering, transforming, consuming trust in Jesus. And look how he brings through the chapter, building up this progression to belief. Firstly, we get Mary. Mary's the first one there. She sees the empty tomb. And she goes and gets John and Peter. And we're told John outraces Peter, gets there first, and John gets there and then looks in. Goes a bit further than Mary did. And then Peter comes, a bit out of breath, a little bit unfit. And Peter goes inside. So Mary's here, sees the tomb. John gets to the edge and looks in. Peter goes right in. And then suddenly in comes John as well, and John sees the grave clothes, and John believes. There's a progression through this story. It's like John saying there's a pathway, a series of steps to belief, an examination of the evidence, taking step after step, looking more and more. And as we this morning look at Jesus, I want to encourage us, are there more steps that we need to take? Are there more questions that we need to ask? Do we need to know more about what the Bible says of Jesus? Do we need to look more at whether historically there's any other evidence for there being a person called Jesus, about his death, about the claims of early Christians? Who is Jesus? What was he like? Did he die? What was his death really like? Was he really raised to life? What is the evidence? John walks that road in this account. And I want to encourage you this morning, if you're on that road, just take another step. Ask another question. John walks to the tomb. Runs to the tomb and then walks, looks in, and Peter goes in. And as John steps into the tomb, sees the lack of the body, sees the grave clothes that once held Jesus' body and now lay abandoned, he believes. He says, I didn't get it all,
Look down at verse 8 and 9. Finally, the other disciple, John, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead.
It says, John believed. He got something of it, something recognised within his heart that Jesus is not here because he's alive. And he didn't get it all. But he got one little or massive truth. That Jesus had risen. Consider Mary again with me. She saw Jesus. She turns around, she's in the grave, in the grave, and she turns around, and there's a man behind her. And she physically, literally sees Jesus, but it's not until he speaks that word, Mary, that she believes, that she gets it, that Jesus is alive. Jesus says to her, as she runs to him, clings on to him, he says, "Don't hold on to me." Verse 17, "For I have not yet ascended to my Father." See, it's not a physical Jesus, even in that moment. He's not saying, "Hang on to me, because this is what you need to believe. It's my words, it's my instructions." Seeing Jesus is not what we need. It's what John points us to. Mary sent out with great news. Go and tell the disciples that I'm alive. Go and share the good news of the resurrection. Jesus is alive and he's going to the Father. But did you hear what he said at the end? It's not just his Father. It's theirs. Verse 17, Jesus says, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." This is it. Jesus' triumphant message is that through his death and his resurrection, he has changed forever people's relationship with God. People who were once enemies of God, estranged from God, who by nature we reject God, his ways, his rules, his commands, his goodness. And as John tracks through the story of these men who follow Jesus and women who follow Jesus, he calls them servants. Just before his death, he says, "You're no longer servants, you're friends." And now after his death and resurrection, they're no longer just friends, but they are brothers and sisters. They are in the family. "I'm ascending to my Father and your Father." The Lord Jesus Christ has brought us to a point where we can share in his relationship with God. No longer separated. No longer completely set apart. But now brought into the family. Adopted. As somebody who was praying earlier. So encouraging to hear that taking hold of the fact that we are now part of God's family. Jesus says, "I'm going to heaven." And his implication is that one day we too will go to be with the Father. Where Jesus has gone, his people will follow. His Father, our Father. But what difference? What difference does that make to you, to me today? What difference does it make to believe that 2,000 years ago a man was raised to life? Let me read you a couple of lines from Lord of the Rings. The end, after the ring has been destroyed. Sorry, spoiler. And the Fellowship are being reunited. And Gandalf, who had died in the first film, appears at the bedside of Frodo and Sam. And Sam says, "Gandalf, I thought you were dead. But then I thought I was dead myself. Is everything sad going to come untrue? What's happened to the world?" Gandalf says, "A great shadow has departed." As we think about Mary, as we think about ourselves, this great truth is that something has changed. Something has happened that changes things forever. Sam sees somebody who he thought was dead now alive. And for Mary, that's exactly what she's seen. Jesus was dead and now he's alive. This great seismic event has happened which changes everything. We often talk about turning points, don't we? Turning points in, you know, maybe you look back to your school days and you think, and there was a time where somebody said something to me and I realised that I actually needed to work hard. I actually started studying and it really changed. It was a turning point. Or maybe a turning point in your career when you got the right job. Or a turning point in a relationship. What happens in the resurrection is the greatest turning point in all of history. Because something happens that has never happened before. Somebody was died, was raised to life, never to die again. That's the claim of Christianity. That Jesus was literally dead and he literally was raised to new life, never, ever, ever to die again. It goes completely against everything that all of humanity has experienced across all of time. That there would be life that goes on. This is the event, the resurrection of Jesus. This is not like stock markets where something happens and they take a spike, but only in a few weeks or months to take another change, a downturn or another upturn. It's not like our lives that go up and down and up and down. What's happened is an event that changes things forever, changes the reality of all life for all people across all time and history. Because there is a life that will not end, a human life, Jesus' life. And what does that mean to Mary? What difference does it make as she stands there by the grave and meets the risen Jesus? She knows now that there is hope for permanent change. Not just a good day or a good week, but something has happened which means that there is a fixed point of reference, which means there can always be good. There is hope that things will be changed forever. Ultimately, there is hope, not just life after death, but purpose in life now. Meaning now. And not just for her individually, but for them together. She sent to Jesus' brothers. Together they have this collective hope of life. Collective corporate unity. Mary, John, Peter, the others. All who come to this saving trust in Jesus. All who would say, I trust in him. His Father is my Father. His God is my God. He has been raised. And so there is hope now that I too will be raised. Not just hope that next week might be better than last week. That life will improve if certain circumstances change. I want to encourage you this morning, examine the evidence. John says, I've written that you might believe. And in believing, find life. For no life that's offered in this world lasts. No circumstances last forever because death stops them all. What if somebody has defeated death? Has defeated the cause of death, sin? Has defeated the consequences? What if there is life everlasting? That's what Jesus says that he offers. Why don't you take another step this morning to examine that? Is it true? Is it true? That's the testimony of this church. That's why we meet together every Sunday morning, we meet together in home groups. We are a people who, just like Mary, have met the risen Jesus. We know that he lives. We know that he's active, working in our lives. He is our only hope. Our hope of life now and our hope of life forever. Because he's the one who defeated death. The only and certain hope of life after death. And so as a church, we're going to do what Mary did. We're going to go out and tell people we have met Jesus. I have seen the Lord. That's our mission as a church. That's why we're here. To say, to a world, there is hope, there is life, and it comes only through Jesus. I'm going to pray.